stop these kinds of developments. Although Northwest Innovation Works may still try to build its one remaining methanol refinery across the Columbia River at Port Westward, Oregon, the community is already organizing to take it on. For Making Contact, I'm Barbara Bernstein in Kalama, Washington.
You've been listening to the world's largest methanol refinery on Making Contact. This program was written, produced, and engineered by Barbara Bernstein. And I'm this week's host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held. There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma, and I use she and her pronouns. And tonight, we're extremely honored to have Chrissy Stroop with us. Chrissy, welcome to Transpositive.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma. It's great to join you.
Thank you. First of all, Chrissy, what are your pronouns?
She, her.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We were just, we heard a Transpositive. We've been following you for a number of years, and several people had written to the show and asking, please get Chrissy Stroop on the show. And I was just so excited when you, you agreed that you could come on Transpositive. So
I was very pleased. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to. I was just going to say, very pleased to get the invitation. And I want to give a thank you to those listeners out there who asked me to be for me to be invited.
So, Chrissy, let's start by just, first of all, just kind of saying, tell us a little bit about who is Chrissy Stroop?
Good question. I've been working on figuring that out for 41 years at this point. But, I grew up very conservative Christian in Indiana, and then for 2.5 years in the early to mid-90s in Colorado Springs, which for those who know much about Colorado Springs, that's precisely the time, and it was transformed into the evangelical Christian dystopia it is today. So that was interesting. It's kind of a part of that because my dad is a music pastor, and he went out there to be part of a new church, what they call a church plant. It's like a startup church under the auspices of a particular denomination. I went to Christian schools in both places. So I got indoctrinated in this extreme right-wing view of the world. I did not have as a kid, any concept of what it might mean to be transgender. I just always felt different and sort of off and uncomfortable in my own skin.
Chrissy, when I was a kid or young, I was raised conservative Christian as well. And I wrote a book of Christian poetry that I sent to Dr. James Dobson.
Oh my God.
Colorado Spring Kings. And now I'm a Jewish atheist. So that's like where I, but so I, yeah, wow. I totally know the history of where you're talking about.
Yeah, Focus on the Family moved there in 1992. Did you get a reply from Dobson?
No, I never did.
Am I allowed to? On the radio.
Oh, sorry. No, that's going to be bleeped out.
Sorry, I'm used to doing podcasts lately, and yeah. So I tend to forget the FCC rules. that jerk. Anyway.
So you didn't, when you were growing up, you were talking about transgender.
Right. So, you know, I would say that I didn't know that I was queer. And that is partly because I know I was and still am also attracted to, you know, girls, women. And so I just felt different somehow, though, and never felt comfortable really with masculinity, and certainly not the conservative Christian kind of toxic version of it. And people would even kind of joke about it in high school and, you know, ask me, like, why are you an Alanis Morissette fan? And I didn't realize that this was, like, such an egregious thing, like, to, like, an angry woman rocker who, you know, has some things to say about men's bad behavior, among other things. So they would tease me, and, you know, I would admit that I didn't fit into masculine stereotypes, but I would just say, but I'm comfortable in my masculinity, which always meant exactly one thing. I like girls. But, you know, it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I realized I also can be attracted to men. And then shortly thereafter, I also realized I was trans. I just couldn't put the pieces together until I was 33.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on getting to that point of realization in your life.
Thanks.
Yeah. So Chrissy, you're a columnist and you're a writer. Can you tell our audience about some of the publications that you write for and what you write about?
Sure. I've written for a pretty wide array of publications. Many that would fall to the sort of more alternative side of the media, but some that are more mainstream. I've written a few articles for Foreign Policy magazine, for example. I've written a number of articles for Playboy that were published online only. I do have one contribution to a forum that was also published in a print edition, which I think they're still doing those. They were as of a few years ago. And they were selling for like $16 at the newsstand. I think it's just kind of a legacy thing. They at least at that time were, you know, along with the rebranding after, you know, Hugh Hefner's death, trying to keep the print magazine alive. And, you know, vintage editions are kind of collector's items in some cases. And I bought 6 issues of the one with my forum column in it, not because in that vein, but because Stormy Daniels is also in that issue. And so I'm figuring that one might really be a decent collector's item.
Oh,
someday.
Yes, definitely.
So Playboy, and I write most frequently for Religion Dispatches. I have the title of senior correspondent there. I'll just be frank, that doesn't come with a salary. It's not a staff writer position, but I have a good working relationship with the editor there. I'm happy to be a part of that publication. And if that publication were ever to have a larger budget, you know, I would definitely benefit from that and maybe become something like a staff writer. But I'm proud of that affiliation. So I still just get paid per piece. And I've also written for the pro-democracy outlet, The Conversationalist. I've written a couple pieces for Dame magazine.
Love Dame.
Dame is really great. And yeah, I write for John Sturr's editorial board, and that stuff also appears on Alternet.
Yeah, I see. I've seen your stuff all over the place. Have I seen your work in the New York Times before?
I have been mentioned and quoted a couple times in the New York Times, but I have not published in the New York Times yet.
So, okay.
Yeah, one of these days, maybe, you know, that's like one of those bucket list milestones that as a writer slash commentator on current events, we probably all hope to check that box at some point.
Mm-hmm. And how, Chrissy, how did you become interested in being a writer? How did this become part of your life?
Sort of a funny thing. When I was a kid, you know, there were a number of things I thought that I wanted to be, but I always read a lot, right? I loved reading. I would get lost in literature and, you know, would often find myself identifying with female protagonists, heroines in certain books. I liked Nancy Drew better than the Hardy Boys. I really liked just about everything by Beverly Cleary, who of course is died, I think, earlier this year and is from Portland. She was a wonderful children's author. And her books were already old by the time that I had them, but yeah, I got them from my mom, who had also read them as a kid. So, so you know, I really liked the character of Ramona, for example. I read a bunch of other stuff. I mean, I was pretty young, I think, when I read Flowers for Algernon. It's kind of shocking, I think, that my parents let me read that one. But that's the funny thing. A lot of fundamentalist parents are very controlling of their children's reading and that sort of thing. And mine were rather hands-off on that front, which began to create a lot of cognitive dissonance for me. But yeah, so I read voraciously, and at a certain point I thought I wanted to be a writer, like that would be cool. And then by the time I was a teenager, I still had that sort of idea of wouldn't it be great to be a writer, thinking mostly of writing fiction, which is something I still hope to do someday. But for the time being, I write essays and nonfiction, sometimes reporting, but it's usually what we would call advocacy journalism rather than straight journalism, because honestly, I think straight journalism is pretty much broken in America. And, you know, hey, I can't really do anything straight, as it were, but
I loved Nancy. I loved Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. So my mother had all those books too, and from like when they were printed, like back in the 50s, you know.
Yeah.
And they've been sitting on the bookshelf. I love the large print and the style of the writing, and I love Nancy Drew too. That was like, I mean, I enjoyed the Hardy Boys, but it was Nancy Drew was totally my. So yeah. And Flowers for an Algernon. Ugh.
Oh, that book. Oh man.
Yeah.
So and maybe did you also read Bridge to Terabithia as a kid?
No, I didn't read that one.
That one also just, you know, right through the heart.
And Beverly Cleary, yeah, she just died. I think it was last year. She was 95. And there's actually a park named after her here in Portland. And a school, too.
I've seen the school. I've never been to that park. I'm going to have to find it sometime.
Yeah, we have so many great authors from Portland. Both currently living here and, you know, originally from here. So,
I thought I wanted to be a writer. And then as I got a little older, I didn't know exactly what subject I wanted to study in college, but I already kind of decided by some point in high school that I wanted to go on to grad school and be a college professor. That seemed like a pretty great career option. You got to research, you got to write, and you still had a non-precarious, comfortable middle-class life, right? That that sounded pretty good. And I have, I guess it's my mom's first cousin, so I always lose track of what that makes him to me. But, you know, a relative who was around sometimes, who was a college professor. And when I was a kid, I didn't realize that, you know, the differences and sort of the hierarchy there of like, you know, professors who just teach and they're more at like teaching colleges and then those who also do research. He was fun. He liked to play Trivial Pursuit. He always seemed somewhat more open-minded than my immediate family. And So I think that's kind of where I got the idea that maybe I wanted to be a college professor. And also, there's a lot of teachers in my family. My grandma, after her kids were old enough to go to school, she went back to school and became a fourth grade teacher. My grandma on my mom's side. Then my mom also became an elementary school teacher. She teaches at Christian, she's taught at Christian schools almost her entire career. I actually had her for part of the day in fifth grade, which was a little weird. But yeah, so education seemed like something that I was always good at school. I was always encouraged that, oh, you can get a college scholarship and, you know, do whatever. So I did that. I went to Ball State University, got the full academic ride scholarship there, the Weidinger Scholarship. Took a year between college and grad school to teach English in Russia and work on learning Russian. And then I went to grad school to study Russian history. And the whole reason I even got interested in that was because I ended up going on two, and this is a bit embarrassing, evangelical short-term mission trips to Russia in 1999 and 2000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 1999 was the year I graduated high school. So that summer, I went to Russia with a group called OMS International. It's a multi-denominational missionary group that's based in Greenwood, Indiana. And the name at that time was just initials. They told me that it had previously been, it had previously stood for Oriental Missionary Society, which is kind of cringe, you know. But here's the really funny part. I don't think they cared or maybe didn't even pick up on how dated and imperialist it sounds to use the term Oriental. They just said that, oh, our mission expanded beyond the Orient. So we just became initials. And now it has rebranded. And I just, you know, checked the website a couple of years ago and learned about this as One Mission Society. And this is so tacky. There's a little ticker in the upper right-hand corner of the website that keeps going up. And it's supposedly like the number of souls that are getting saved by missionaries working for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure if they actually quote unquote saved that many souls that like everyone in the world would be Christian very soon. So I color me skeptical, but yeah. So if people want the whole story on that, I did finally write about that 20 years later in my essay contribution to my co-edited anthology of personal essays with Lauren O'Neill, Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Lauren and I wrote the introduction. We both also contributed essays. And then there's a very diverse group of writers, some more established, some less established, from conservative Christian backgrounds who have left conservative Christianity in most cases to become atheists or agnostics. Mm-hmm. In a couple cases, they're still sort of spiritual. And yeah, there's a lot of queer narratives in there. A solid majority of the stories are by women. So that was a project I'm proud to have gotten out there, published with the small press Epiphany, based back in my native Indianapolis.
Thank you. We're talking tonight with Chrissy Stroop. Chrissy is a columnist and a commentator on many issues, but especially issues around separation of church and state, religion. And Chrissy is also a out, can I call you a transgender woman, Chrissy?
Yes, yeah.
Chrissy's an out transgender woman who lives here in Portland. Chrissy, so which came first for you? Did you first come out as queer. It sounds like you have two really big coming out stories. One is kind of coming out as queer, and also the other one is kind of coming out as like non-religious in the way that you were raised. Which one came first? Or did they come at the same time?
It's roughly the same time. It's funny because it's all so sort of mixed up, and I tend to drag everything out until things just kind of explode, and I would highly not recommend that other people emulate me in that. But my deconstruction, as they call it, of my evangelical faith, you know, really began when I was about 16 years old and read the entire Bible through for the first time. And by the time I was, you know, doing those mission trips, I was in a pretty serious crisis of faith. But like I had done my whole life, I was just kind of intellectualizing the whole thing. I learned to live in my head as a kid, and I excelled in school. And so, you know, and I think part of the reason for that is that I didn't feel comfortable in my body, and I didn't quite feel right with just how everything was around me. So I learned to take a step back and become like a little anthropologist. I mean, when I was like 9 years old, I was keeping a notebook of grammar that my grandparents used that was different from grammar that my parents used.
Oh, fun.
You know,
Do you remember any of what you...
Yes, I do. So like my grandpa, if you take the verb to come, and okay, everyone get the giggles out, but it's not in a sexual context here, right? Mm-hmm, so like, you know, come, came would be the three parts of that verb. Well, he didn't say came. If he was using it in the present perfect or the simple past tense, he would still just say come. You know, it's this kind of rural central Indiana dialect. And he did the same thing with the verb give. So, you know, he would be like, and then the doctor come into the room and he give me my prescription. And, you know, I thought that was super interesting because we didn't talk that way. So I wrote that kind of stuff down in that long since disappeared notebook. But I do remember that.
Oh, great.
And then I guess I never really finished totally answering your question of how I ended up becoming a writer, because I go down rabbit trails, and I'm sorry, I just do that sometimes.
That's great.
But you know, that's all kind of related. Anyway, I then tried to become a college professor, and long story short, there aren't any jobs left in my field. I'm one of the Academy's throwaway PhDs. I went to Stanford for my PhD in modern Russian history after teaching English in Russia for a year. And after Stanford, I actually taught some humanities courses in a Russian university in Moscow for 3 years. So that was 2012 to 2015. Very rocky time for international relations with the annexation of Crimea and all of that. My ruble-denominated salary plummeted. Yeah, I fortunately got a postdoc back in America at the University of South Florida in Tampa, so I went there. 2 year postdoc, not renewable after that, got a visiting instructor position for a year, and then just kind of struck out. By that time, I had started writing some things for Religion Dispatches and Political Research Associates, the think tank. So, you know, popular commentary and sort of wonky policy research. And I had set up a Patreon and had started just kind of thinking that I was probably never gonna get that tenure track job, and that I wasn't interested in just doing adjunct teaching, because as much as I love teaching, and you know, I'm gonna just be frank here again, a lot of college professors don't. They wanna be in those research universities and get as many sabbaticals as possible and have the lowest course load possible. I really like working with college students and having the opportunity to be a positive influence and just kind of be there to listen to them and facilitate their learning processes. It's just something I really enjoy because, you know, they're so like young and full of energy and idealism, or they're learning to differentiate themselves from their parents, maybe coming from a more oppressive background like I did. And college professors who became mentors were very important to me. At Ball State University. So, but yeah, I kind of started realizing that the writing was on the wall. And if people asked me when I was working at the University of South Florida, like, you know, when was I going to publish my dissertation as a book, I would tell them, yeah, I'm working on it. And you know, I didn't want to do it before getting a tenure track job, though, because then what would I use to get tenure? So the truth is, I wasn't really working on it very much at all. Mm-hmm. I was mostly working on teaching and writing for popular audiences. But you know, the adjunct teaching, it's you're paid per course. It usually doesn't come with benefits. It doesn't pay enough. And people sometimes eke out a living doing that. You get assigned usually like a lot of sections of the low level courses with lots and lots of students in them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's extremely demoralizing conditions. You're at the very bottom of the hierarchy of, you know, people who work for the university, at least in a teaching or administrative capacity. And you don't really have the time or the bandwidth under those circumstances to really be there, I think, for your students in many cases. And I said, well, I really don't want to do that. So, and I mean, I know that adjuncts are working on unionizing in a lot of places, getting better conditions with a few successes there, but the higher ed is just unfortunately a mess right now. So, you know, I then moved back in with my parents in Indiana. Still not out to them, even. Well, mm-hmm. No, I was out as queer, but I was not out as a trans woman to them.
And were you out as an atheist?
No.
I'm sorry, I didn't ask. Are you an atheist?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And it's really only within the last couple of years that I've become comfortable using the term atheist to describe myself, but I was using the term agnostic before that. But it wasn't really till about 2015 that I was doing that. So I guess I kind of had, but I hadn't really talked to my parents about it. You know, as at least as someone who didn't go to church, as someone who wasn't religious, yes, I guess I was sort of out as that to my parents at that time.
Can I ask you a question, Chrissy? A lot of people don't, even though this show is mostly about trans issues, but a lot of trans and queer folks here in Portland are not religious in any sense of the word. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely at least a related topic. What is the difference between an atheist and a humanist? Because I hear those words used interchangeably all the time. Is it the same thing, or are they different?
Good question. I mean, to me, atheist, even though it sometimes carries implications and cultural baggage, you know, if you take it, it's denotative meaning. It simply means a person who doesn't believe in God or gods, you know. Mm-hmm. And while I don't 100% rule out that I could be wrong, and that there could be some sort of spiritual reality, you know, which that makes me an agnostic atheist. But, you know, like Carl Sagan used to say, I see no compelling evidence for belief in any kind of personal deity. So I, you know, I don't believe in it, but I don't consider that positive knowledge, right? Because positive knowledge in this area is impossible. So yeah, I'm an agnostic atheist. A humanist is someone who subscribes more to a certain philosophy. It generally is a godless philosophy, but it moves beyond simply not believing in any sort of god or gods to you know, elevating humanity and wanting to do good just for the sake of humanity, recognizing human dignity, that sort of thing. You know, there was a humanist manifesto written back in the 70s, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's much more a kind of specific philosophy. And, you know, I would say that in general, my views are pretty humanistic and socialist. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as a humanist. I had a chance to speak virtually at the Nashville, Tennessee Sunday Assembly, you know, those atheist/humanist gatherings. And I got to be honest, before I did it, I was thinking like, okay, I will do this because these seem like nice people, a good organization. It seems like a good thing, but I don't exactly get the Church for Atheists thing. Mm-hmm. But then when I participated in the service, I found it really uplifting, like surprisingly uplifting.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things, I was listening to his podcast the other day, The Thinking Atheist, with, I can't remember, Seth.
Seth Andrews, yeah. Yeah.
Seth Andrews, and he was talking about that same thing, he was talking about how, you know, we shouldn't just let religious folks, like, have a monopoly on community, because, like, both as queer folks and for people who are non-religious, like, we can do community just as well as religious folks can do it. And we can probably do it better because we're much more inclusive, we're more thoughtful, and we don't have as many conditions about, you know, that you can be part of our community. And so, you know, I think that the Sunday Assembly is a great example of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue, you know, how do we build community outside of religious structures, because it's just sort of ingrained into the social fabric of America that religion is where you find supportive community. But for a lot of people, that just doesn't work. And so Sunday Assembly is definitely an interesting experiment. And, you know, I could possibly see myself being a part of something like that, this once a month gathering just to be around like-minded people who believe in human goodness and potential and kindness and, you know, working toward a better future.
So since I have on someone who is a national commentator on issues that I really want to hear your opinion on, I could talk to you all day about all this other stuff, about coming out as an atheist, coming out as queer, your story, because it's really great. But if it's okay, I'd like to shift for just a little bit, and I might pepper you with some other questions, but I'd like to ask you about some stuff that's in the news right now or that's been in the news recently, mostly having to do with religion. Now,
yeah, let me just quickly say, since I never actually said it, that when I finally came out publicly as a transgender woman, it was 2019, and I was kind of pushed into it before I was quite ready by some online bullying. Oh. And it was awkward with my mom, especially, and things are very awkward still with my sister, who kind of just treats me like a dirty, corrupt, degenerate pariah now. Hmm. But I'm actually good with my parents now, like pretty good. They don't always get the name and pronouns right, but mm-hmm. they are trying, and they are, they accept me, they love me, they generally respect my boundaries. They were just out here in the Pacific Northwest for the first time like a week and a half ago.
Oh, great.
And it was fun. Uh-huh. So yeah, unfortunately I have a very strained relationship with my sister at this point. Who's actually become more fundamentalist, and mm-hmm. My parents actually moderated, and they got their COVID vaccines and everything, and you mm-hmm. know, while my sister was spreading anti-mask and anti-vax propaganda and begging them not to get vaccinated.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thanks.
That's so great though about your parents. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and it was when I was back living with them, thank you, that I finally was, you know, I was there to see if I could start to actually make a living as a writer, or if I needed to then shake the bushes and try to find a job in human rights advocacy, nonprofit sector, or a think tank or something like that. But I started getting more freelance jobs, and I got more Patreon patrons, and so here I am. And, you know, to become a writer too, you also have to have the life experience. And as a kid, you don't really understand what that means. But so by trying to become a college professor and failing, I think I got the life experience I needed to be a writer. So here we are.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, I was just in the news today that the Supreme Court apparently is going to take up a case involving if religious schools may receive taxpayer funding for tuition. Mm. Have you heard about that? Let's talk more broadly about the Supreme Court and what's going on with the court and how
I'm sorry, but is it if they should receive federal funding if they discriminate against LGBTQ people or just in general?
No, if they're going to decide if religious schools may receive taxpayer funding for tuition.
Oh, so like the voucher programs, like elementary,
kind of like the voucher program, yeah.
Elementary, secondary schools,
yes,
not colleges.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, no, I really need to get caught up on certain things. So I had missed that, but that's not going to go well.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Supreme Court first, just kind of from a broad view. What do you see going on right now at the Supreme Court? If you want to talk about trans or queer issues, go ahead. If you want to just talk about religion, which is your forte, let's focus on that. What's going on like in the next couple of years? I mean, we just got on Amy Barrett. And then
Amy Coney Barrett. Yeah.
Amy Coney Barrett. Thank you. And, you know, Kavanaugh. I mean, we have the makings of the apocalypse, quite honestly.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, it's looking really bad.
I really, really don't like this court. And it's a fundamentally illegitimate court.
Yeah.
I mean, our institutions are pretty broken at the national level.
Mm-hmm.
People talked so much during the Trump years about, well, look, he's awful. He's obviously an authoritarian, but our institutions have checked him. Well, yeah, sometimes, but they also continued to erode pretty quickly. And I really worry about what will happen in 2022 and 2024 with the gerrymandering that's happening right now, the voter suppression that Republicans are enacting in states that they control, and the seeming inability of the Biden administration or this nominally Democratic Congress to find the spine to do anything about it. And another one of those things that they should be doing something about in order to simply restore fairness, but they're not, is the Supreme Court. You know, Kavanaugh should be impeached, and they ought to at least, if they're not going to remove Coney Barrett, and they should add another seat because, you know, the at least one other seat, because the Republicans really played extremely dirty with the Supreme Court. President Barack Obama, listeners will most likely recall, nominated Merrick Garland to Antonin Scalia's seat that came open during his term. And Mitch McConnell suddenly invented this precedent that, oh, well, when it's like the end of a term in an election year, we don't hold hearings to approve a new SCOTUS justice. And then, of course, they turned around and did exactly that with the extremely rushed nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. And so Trump and McConnell stacked the court with Federalist Society, Opus Dei approved, far-right Christian, mostly Catholic justices, in many cases with rather flimsy resumes to even be there. And these are, of course, lifelong appointments. I mean, in theory, there is an impeachment process, but it's not typically used. So they just basically stole a couple of seats and skewed the court, already pretty conservative court, even further to the right. It's bad. And one of the areas where it's especially bad is when it comes to the separation of church and state. To be sure, the court, and this actually surprised me, thanks to Gorsuch and Roberts, did in the Bostock decision, recognize that non-discrimination rules in the workplace do apply. So gender non-discrimination, sex non-discrimination does apply to queer people. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's good.
Yeah, that was a big victory. That was good.
But where they're turning around and eroding separation of church and state has to do with just carving out basically infinite exemptions. I mean, we already had the Hobby Lobby case, which decided that a small, closely held corporation can be religious and therefore can force its employees to follow the religious views of the CEO, which is absurd. And you know, we're just going to see with that precedent more and more religious exemptions being carved out that do ultimately undermine the principle of equal accommodation for all in the public square. So sure, non-discrimination in theory, but in practice, not so much. In healthcare, just think about how many hospitals are controlled by Catholics, and in some cases by certain Protestant denominations that will not say give maybe transgender people needed healthcare or will not perform a medical
medical procedure
for, well, so I mean they won't give someone like a chemical treatment to get rid of an ectopic pregnancy, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, they have to do this whole dangerous invasive surgery to take out the fallopian tube.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's absurd. But they make this distinction in Catholic theology that, well, if you just do that, you're not actually killing the little tiny mass of cells there, mm-hmm. which they see as a baby with a soul and everything, which is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're just letting it die. So, you know, who cares about how much more painful and difficult this is for the woman or trans man who is in this situation,
mm-hmm.
right? That clears their conscience. But a hospital shouldn't care. I mean, the decision should be based on medical science alone, right? But so mm-hmm. hospitals, one huge example, a lot of them are controlled by religious groups. And so if you are someone who falls afoul of their religious ideology, you may not get fair standard medical treatment there. And then of course there are small businesses like, you know, bakeries. Do they have to serve same-sex couples for weddings? Or, and I think there's a lot of room there for just more and more discrimination to be allowed. And Christian schools, like elementary and secondary schools receiving funding to indoctrinate kids in far-right ideology is another big problem. Also, deregulated homeschooling. This is more state-by-state stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm quite, you know, concerned that the Supreme Court will take up this issue.
It seems like the Supreme Court is trying to, I mean, from a really broad view, the Supreme Court is trying right now to pick cases that specifically say that the right to the exercise of religion is, I mean, it's a constitutionally protected right, but that it's somehow this right that's under siege, and then it has to be protected in the same way that First Amendment rights are protected. And so they're kind of like flipping the script on all of this great legislation that, I mean, all of these great cases that came before the court, like starting back in the 50s and going through basically like the 70s or the 80s, that fundamentally established.
Sorry about the dog there.
Oh, that's okay. That fundamentally is lit.
Darcy, it's okay. I apologize.
That's all right. That fundamentally established a separation of church and state. And what they're doing right now is they're trying to say that the right to practice religion is this constitutionally protected right that's being discriminated against by the government. Like the government is going and it's preventing children from going to private Christian schools because the government's not giving the money the same way that they do for public schools. So they're trying to like equate the two as if somehow you have a right to receive taxpayer funded, you know, assistance to go to a private school
for your religious practice.
Yeah. And
I mean, you know, let's be clear. I mean, free exercise is a First Amendment protected right, mm-hmm. but you know, there are two sort of opposing clauses there on religion in the First Amendment, right? So there's the free exercise clause, but then there's the establishment clause, right? Government shall make no law. Gosh, why am I failing to remember this off the top of my head?
Prohibiting
government shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or protect or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on that, but something like
that's
that,
okay.
Right? Is in the First Amendment. Uh-huh. So you have both those clauses, and they are focusing on the free exercise clause at the expense of the establishment clause, and there are many. Constitutional scholars, lawyers, and advocates like Andrew Seidel at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who's a friend of mine, you know, who's constantly arguing that these moves are unconstitutional in his view. I mean, the religious freedom is one part of the rhetoric now by which they're trying to establish this, you know, supposed right that is supposedly under siege to send your kids to Christian schools and even somehow be able to afford it, I guess. Never mind that they don't care if people can afford rent, if people can afford food, housing, healthcare, education, but parents got to be able to send their kids to Christian schools, damn it. Mm-hmm. It's weird. There's no right for that. That's mm-hmm. just sort of de facto establishment. The mm-hmm. earlier rhetoric that they used for that more, and they also still use for that, of course, is school choice. You ought to have choice, free markets, competition. If parents can get vouchers to send their kids to private schools, the public schools will have to work harder to compete, they say. But they don't really care about public schools at all. In fact, they would like public schools to go away.
We're talking tonight with Chrissy Stroop. Chrissy is a commentator, a national commentator on issues on issues regarding religion, and lives here in Portland, Oregon, and is a transgender woman. Chrissy, what do you think about one of the things that the religious right has been doing lately? They've been trying to pit transgender rights, and especially trans rights around kids and trans rights around healthcare, against religious rights, and mm-hmm. kind of saying that somehow there's this comparison, like that the radical left is pushing this radical, secular, anti-religious, you know, agenda. Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to, like, I mean, they're saying that we are somehow, like those of us who are queer or trans, are somehow like on the front end of this big push that is against everything that they stand for. Mm-hmm. And they even utilize the language of queer liberation mm-hmm. in order to try to pursue like their own rhetoric, their own rhetorical challenges to the left. For instance, here's an example of this. In the National Review today, a commentator named Wesley Smith writes that the right to transgender health care is akin to freedom of religion. And he's saying that the right to live with integrity is something that left-wing activists are pushing for transgender people. And somehow we can't see that freedom of religion is exactly the same right, and somehow we're denying that. We're denying the right to freedom of religion for people on the right, so that, you know, like I said, they can't send their kids to private Christian school, they can't discriminate against queer people in employment, which they de facto do. We all know it. The women can get birth control, all these abortion, all these horrible things, you know, they're saying mm-hmm. are basically akin to, so they're making this argument that this is some kind of a lifestyle choice, and that, you know, freedom of religion is analogous to that. Have you heard this kind of argument being made by the religious right? And what do you think about that?
Yes, you hear that argument a lot. I haven't read this particular article by Wesley Smith. I don't know who he is, but from the rhetoric, he sounds to me like an evangelical Christian or maybe a right-wing Catholic who's borrowed some of their rhetoric. But when they compare everything to religion, to get a little bit wonky for a minute, they're using a technique that is called presuppositionalist Christian apologetics. Basically, presuppositionalists argue that we all come to reality as we see it, to evidence, with different presuppositions in mind. And so what your presuppositions are determine what you're going to see when you look at science or whatever. And there's sort of no way to adjudicate between these different worldviews. Two presuppositionalists, you know, if you have like what they would call an evolutionist and a scientist, and they both go look at the Grand Canyon, it's not that the evolutionist comes to the conclusion of how the Grand Canyon was carved out over longs of geologic, you know, not because the evidence actually suggests that, but because of their presuppositions. And the creationist will say, oh, well, it was all created by Noah's flood. And turns out, hey, both those things are just as scientifically plausible. Spoiler alert, they are not. And so it's this kind of sleight of hand where they say, nobody knows anything, therefore we are right. And part of that is making all these other worldviews into religions competing with Christianity. So it doesn't surprise me that they would compare being transgender to a religion. You know, back in April, there was a sort of ridiculous essay published by the CEO of Gab, the far-right social media site, arguing that people who support the COVID vaccine are engaging in a religious ritual. And so Christians have the right to refuse the vaccine, so they have their religious freedom. It's all over the place right now, and it's very bizarre. But you know, if you Christian apologetics, that is defense of the faith, you come from that background, you kind of recognize what they're doing. It's weird because these are the same people who like to tell you that relativism is terrible and it's destroying humanity, but then they make this really nihilistic relativistic move, you know, that they just believe they're right because they believe that the Holy Spirit tells them that the Bible is entirely true and infallible and blah, blah, blah. And they're also often very against public schools because the public schools, and they sometimes actually call them government schools or even indoctrination centers, which is a case of projection going on there. They see public schools as indoctrinating children in secular humanism. And they have just as little idea of what secular humanism actually is as they do of what critical race theory is, which is another one of their big bugbears, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't believe that you can have any kind of public neutrality. Everyone is just competing for their own religion, whether that religion is environmentalism or evolution or being transgender or whatever, you know? So they'll say there's no neutrality. Everyone just has to, it's a kind of Hobbesian war of all against all sort of view, right? It's not a view that ultimately accepts pluralism and pluralism. I mean, in any modern society, pluralism is basically just left on the ground, right? We're diverse, we have lots of people, different backgrounds, different experiences, different views. But they reject the notion that, you know, we need to accept pluralism and find ways to navigate it and embrace it in building a democratic society. They instead see it as we're all competing to dominate. And that's an extremely anti-democratic, dangerous, extremist way of looking at things. Yeah. We'll be right back.
Well, Christy, we're getting near the end of our interview. And so, Christy, is there anything that we haven't covered today that you'd just like to share, anything that you're working on right now, or any topics that we haven't gotten to that we want to make sure to come around to?
Well, thanks for that question, Emma. I am currently working on a single author book project. So my first one, I wrote a book length work in my dissertation, but I didn't publish it. And then I did that essay anthology. But I'm working on sort of a history of the Christian right and its politics from roughly the 1970s to the present, but framed around my own experiences and then interviews with other people like me who grew up in the Christian right and rejected it. So I think that's a really interesting lens through which to view the history of the culture wars, and that the voices of former conservative Christians, including ex-evangelicals, ex-Mormons, ex-Catholics, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and so forth, really need to be heard in our national discussion these days. Not just because as people directly affected by Christian right politics, we are stakeholders in those discussions, and we should be listened to for that reason, but also because those of us who grew up in extreme right-wing environments understand those environments and the people in those environments and their ideology, and we can help unpack that for the broader public that hasn't experienced that. So yeah, the working title of the book is Children of the Culture Wars. I think it's going to be a long time coming, but I'm hoping to have a sample chapter done for, agents to peruse by maybe the middle of October. That's the goal.
Oh, that's so exciting. I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thanks, Emma.
Yeah, thank you. So we've been talking tonight with Christy Stroop. Christy is a national columnist on religion and a transgender woman who lives here in Portland. It's really been a pleasure having you on Transpositive, Christy. I hope that we got enough time to talk about issues related to trans identity and queerness. There's only so much time, though, and I really wanted to make sure we got the religion stuff, because I know that's your forte. So,
yeah, well, thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I'm grateful to have been invited and would be glad to come back anytime.
Thank you. And Christy, if people want to find you on social media or online, where can they go to find you or your work?
So I am pretty active on Twitter. So that's kind of my main social media. I'm at @C_Stroop there. I'm really bad at Instagram, so probably don't follow me there.
Follow you on Twitter then, @C_Stroop.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Christy. It's been a real pleasure having you on Transpositive. Thank you so much and have a good night.
Thanks, Emma. You too.
I got my COVID-19 vaccination, and here's why. This isn't about gimmicks or sentiment or what commercial I like. This is about facts. COVID-19 vaccines are safe and effective. Millions of doses have already been given in the United States, and these vaccines have the most intensive safety monitoring in U.S. history. People from different races, ages, genders, and ethnicities participated in large clinical trials around the world to make sure this vaccine worked for all kinds of people. The amount of time and effort dedicated to developing these vaccines was huge. Scientists used existing research and technology so they could get the vaccines developed quickly and safely without skipping any steps. If you need any more information, use a reliable source like the CDC website to get the facts.
Este es un mensaje de los Centros para el Control y la Prevención de Enfermedades. Los adultos mayores y las personas de cualquier edad que tengan afecciones subyacentes graves están en mayor riesgo de enfermarse gravemente con el COVID-19. Si usted está en mayor riesgo, debe quedarse en casa tanto como sea posible y evitar el contacto cercano con personas que estén enfermas para protegerse a usted mismo. Llame al médico si está preocupado por el COVID-19 y su afección, o si se enferma. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/Spanish.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Long Strange Trip, the history of the Grateful Dead, Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This Grateful Dead documentary will be shown as a benefit for KBOO to celebrate 20 years of Grateful Dead and Friends on the air. This is an all-ages event and masks are required. You can buy tickets at kboo.fm and support KBOO getting a